Okay, Didactic Mind, episode 38, Return to Tribe. Very warm welcome to all of my loyal readers. Very warm welcome to all of my SoundCloud subscribers. I know this one is a couple of days late, and that was just completely unavoidable. there's some stuff that happened this weekend, and I'm not going to go into it. It was pretty interesting, but just kept me very, very busy for, you know, basically from Saturday night all the way through to Sunday evening. And by Sunday evening, I basically sat down with a large, what's it called, half liter of beer. What does that translate into in Queen of England? I don't know. What is the actual conversion? Pints to liters. What is it? Yeah, it's about a pint of beer. I had real beer, proper beer, you know, German dark beer, Steinbrenner, I think it was. Very good, by the way. I'm not a big beer drinker. I don't advocate for drinking beer. Red wine is my thing, particularly the sort of more bold reds, Shiraz Cabernet, Cabernet Sauvignon, that sort of thing. Merlot, if I'm feeling like a more of a sweet sort of wine, but I do enjoy a good beer from time to time. And when you're a bit short on sleep and you're in a nice place and you're drinking a large beer, your ability to think coherently is somewhat reduced to the point where podcasting, or in my case it would have been drunk casting, is inadvisable, especially when you're trying to deal with serious topics. But anyway, we're back now, and I hope to keep this back on a regular footing soon. So, depending on your point of view, you will either be treated or burdened by two podcasts this week. This one and the next one. The blog is didactsreach.blogspot.com, though that will move eventually. I mean, soon. It should be within the next week or so, once I finally find the time to just sit down and do the damn migration. Be sure also to visit my other website, one of my niche sites, my first niche site, in fact, superbshaving.com. If you like what I do, you like the content that I produce, then stop by that site and peruse through some of the articles. There are a few up there now. Look at some of the products that I have listed, which it's all about shaving, traditional wet shaving, how to give yourself the best possible shave, and to really, you know, save a lot of money in the process. Those of you who are new to wet shaving, that should be your introduction to a much better way of doing things. The old ways when it comes to shaving are absolutely the best, and I have all the products and tips and pointers that you need to get started. So, like I said, you like what I do, you want to support me, you want to kick a few bucks my way, because I could definitely use it, stop by that website and order some stuff off of Amazon, and I will be able to, you know, keep doing this sort of thing. It will be your way of helping me out, and your way of helping out people like me who just really, you know, want to keep telling the truth. So, superbshaving.com. And, you know, like I said, stop by there and check it out. So today, I want to talk about tribes and the importance of tribes to our fundamental sense of well-being and connectedness, our sense of identity. I was watching a really interesting movie recently called American History X. And it's a very powerful film. I mean, I haven't finished watching it yet, maybe halfway through it. But if you watch it, I'm not going to give away the plot for you. Highly recommend you watch it. It's a phenomenal performance from Edward Norton. And Edward Furlong, actually, who played... I didn't recognize him at first, and then someone pointed out to me, hey, that's the kid from Terminator. I was like, no, it wasn't. And then it turns out, yeah, it really was. It was the kid from Terminator, and she was right. And so I basically, sat and, you know, watched through the movie itself, And it is a very powerful character study in a lot of ways. It is a very difficult movie to watch, but I highly recommend it because there is a scene, or there's a set of flashback scenes about one third of the way into the film, where you're basically looking at a neo-Nazi, if you will, explaining how he became a neo-Nazi. And that set of arguments happens as Edward Norton's character walks up to a gang of white youths, skinheads, on the streets of Los Angeles, and he tells them a bunch of just brutal, no-nonsense facts about what it's like to be white in L.A. Now, bear in mind, this film was made, what, 20-some years ago? Longer than that? When was it made? American History X was made at some point in the last 25 years. So, 1998, you know, so, yeah, 22 years ago. Bear in mind that downtown L.A., or Los Angeles in general, was very much heading full steam down the road that it is now to lawlessness, crime, and internecine gang warfare, where you have basically gangs of Hispanics and blacks at war with each other. And this is something you won't hear from the mainstream media. They refuse to talk about it, because it goes against the narrative that white people are always to blame for everything, which they're not. But the movie makes this incredibly powerful point where Edward Norton's character is standing in front of these white youths and telling them, these people have invaded our country, they come into our homes, they take our jobs, they consume our welfare, they turn our country into what their country is like. And we don't get a vote. We don't get anybody standing up for us. We don't have anyone on our side. We don't have any sense of our own identity. We don't have anyone looking out for us. We, white people, are persecuted in our own country. That's basically what he says. And the funny thing is, you know, I understand that the point of the movie is to say, racism bad. Well, okay, fine. It does it in a rather more subtle way than that, and is much more sophisticated about it than just racism bad. You could get that from any number of really crappy Hollywood movies today. But what's really good about this film is it makes you sympathize with the character of what's his name? What was it? I forgot his name. I can't believe it. I mean, I was watching it just yesterday. But Danny, whatever his name was. Derek. Yeah, Danny Vineyard and Derek Vineyard, his older brother. It really makes you sympathize with the character of Derek Vineyard. And the reason that's important is that you feel, you sympathize with his arguments even as you deplore the violence that he employs. And it is violence. I mean, the scene right after that speech that Norton gives involves people crashing into a grocery store owned by a Korean man and staffed by Mexicans and blacks and committing horrific violence upon them. So you can sit there and you can watch this and you can say to yourself, you know what? I actually agree with a lot of what he's saying. I agree with most of what he's saying. And that's certainly the feeling that I got. I agreed with pretty much everything that Edward Norton was saying, because it's true. And then, you know, this gang of white hoodlums goes in and just trashes a store, beats up people, and does horrible things to them. And you can deplore that violence no matter who does it. Whether it's white, black, Hispanic, whatever, it doesn't matter the race. What matters is that these people have abandoned the covenant of civilization. They have resorted to brute force and mob intimidation to get their point across. And the interesting thing is that you can see exactly why someone from a white middle class, you know, well-heeled family would turn to neo-Nazi ideology. Here's the thing. Nazism, National Socialism, is an unbelievably stupid, unbelievably retarded form of political ideology. It is socialism. It is left-wing. It is fascism is of the left. And if anybody tells you otherwise, he's an idiot. He hasn't done any of the necessary reading. And he doesn't understand that fascism is a direct offshoot of Karl Marx's communist theories. The man behind the entire doctrine of fascism, Giovanni Gentile, wrote the pamphlet on the doctrine of fascism, I think in conjunction with Il Duce, Benito Mussolini himself, and it was called Il Dottrino del Fascismo, in which Gentile made the point that class struggle and class warfare isn't effective in delivering socialism. It's not. Marx was wrong about that, and Gentile proposed that instead of dividing society along the lines of class, you divide them along the lines of state or nation. And that would be a much more effective way of establishing a socialist nation, where you made it very clear who is us and who is them. Now, because fascism recognizes national boundaries and states and nations, it is marginally more workable than communism. When I say marginally, I mean it is more effective than communism, which is totally ineffective, simply because it recognizes some basic realities of human nature. That is not to say that fascism is a good idea. That is not to say that it works, because it doesn't. It's a stupid idea. It's an astonishingly idiotic thing to resort to. And the people who say that fascism works haven't done their homework. Similarly, the people who say that people like Augusto Pinochet and General Franco in Spain were fascist really haven't done their homework. I fought against this for 20 years in trying to point out that, for instance, the International Baccalaureate syllabus, which I studied as a student, was wrong. And in all honesty, it's been a futile fight because people still believe this lie. But at any rate, the important lesson to learn from all of that was and is that your tribe matters. And the reason why the kids in that movie turn to neo-Nazism and fascism is because nobody in the mainstream, nobody in politics, nobody in academia, the media, the political classes, takes their concerns seriously. Nobody's willing to stand up for these kids, these people, and say, you know what? This tribe of white people has a legitimate grievance, a legitimate concern, and what is being done to them is effectively ethnic cleansing. Because it is unrestricted, untrammeled immigration coming in from across the border, they're seeing their way of life destroyed. They're seeing their neighborhoods changed in ways that they don't want. They're seeing a way of life imposed upon them that they don't want. This is exactly the situation that much of the West is facing today, much of the white Western world is facing today. It's not just white people, I mean, there are many ethnic communities around the world that are facing the same problem. But white people, for some reason, their concerns don't count, which to me is just wrong. I'm not white. I mean, I have lived around white people my whole life. I have been around white people for the entirety of my conscious existence. And for some reason, I have always been told, and I have always heard, and I've always been fed the propaganda that white people are what's wrong with the world, that white people are the reason why I have to work twice as hard in order to get the same job, or I have to be twice as good in order to achieve the same results. But that's not what I've seen. What I've actually seen in my own personal experience is that white people are actually pretty great. White people have always treated me very kindly. White people have always been very decent to me. I have never in my life, except maybe for the time that I was in Australia, experienced significant racism from whites. And I've said this repeatedly. I have written about this repeatedly on my blog. I have said this repeatedly on these podcasts. And I will say it again. There is nothing inherently wrong with white people. It is okay to be white. And I'm sick and tired of people telling me that white people are evil, because they're not. The least racist people I've ever come across in my whole life are white people. The most racist people I've ever come across in my whole life are Chinese people. Does that make all Chinese people evil and bad? Of course not. That's just an idiotic argument. But does that mean that there are certain aspects of Chinese character which are not compatible with certain aspects of, shall we say, white Western character? Absolutely yes. It's unquestionably true. So that comes really down to the theme of who is your tribe and who's going to stand up for you. And this is especially relevant in the current day and age. It is tempting to look around you, very tempting, in fact, to look around you and think to yourself, you know, Lord, I want to get out of this place. I want to get out of the USA. I want to get out of the Western world. It's all gone to hell. I don't recognize my country anymore. It's lawless. It's brutal. It's dis-civic. It's anarchic. I'm seeing my neighborhoods transformed by people who don't look like me, don't think like me, don't talk like me. They don't walk. They don't eat. They don't worship. They don't act anything like I do. These are not my people, my tribe. Where is my tribe? And this is the central folly and flaw of the Western multiculturalist approach to doing things. Western people have been told for the better part of 50 years that multiculturalism is good and that it is right and necessary and just to let in all of the world's immigrants and the world's people, regardless of skin color, race, ethnicity, IQ, religion, whatever, into their borders. And that anyone who shows up in, let's say, Britain and gets British permanent residency and then citizenship is just as British as somebody whose family has been there since the days of Alfred the Great. It's absolute nonsense. It's ridiculous. I mean, I can tell you this as somebody who's been in that world and seen it, and experienced it firsthand, and many of my listeners have been involved in that firsthand experience as well. They've seen what it's like to see their own neighborhoods replaced and deracinated and acculturated and subsumed into this globalist morass, which is nothing like what they grew up with. It's just wrong, and it's ridiculous. But I try to tell this to, you know, people during my travels. I try to tell this to people who live in countries with a strong sense of community. I try to tell this to Russians, and they can't believe a word that I'm saying. They're like, that's ridiculous. Why would anybody allow that to happen to their country? And the reason for that is because the Russians understand very plainly who is Russian and who is not. Now, you could argue that the Russians are diluting their own definition of who is Russian, because they've essentially just signed up or signed into law a provision that allows something like 10 million new Russian citizens, you know, quote-unquote Russians, to get Russian citizenship. But here's the thing. The people who would qualify for Russian citizenship are either Russian by blood or from the original former Soviet Union state, and as a result, they have a shared history, a shared tradition, and a shared language. In order to become a Russian citizen, you have to demonstrate at least some degree of Russian-speaking ability if you're from those former Soviet Union republics, like Moldova or Georgia, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, you know, all the Uzbekistan countries. You have to demonstrate some level of ability to speak the language. And I know, because I speak a little bit of it, just how hard that is to do. I also understand, because I've lived there for a while now, just how challenging and complex Russian history and traditions are. So you can't just rock up and pretend to be Russian. It's not like the way it is in Canada or the US or the UK, where somehow the dirt is magical, where you just land up in Canada or Britain or the USA or various, you know, like Germany. I mean, Germany allowed in hundreds of thousands of quote-unquote refugees and migrants. They were nothing of the sort. They were economic migrants. They were not refugees for the most part. And somehow those people are just as German as people who have been there since, the days of Charlemagne, you know. They're just not. They're not Germans. Just the same as people who land up in America are not Americans just by setting foot on American soil. I can tell you that the process of acculturating to America takes a long time. It took me, 3-4 years from the time I arrived in the U.S. to consider it home. But it was never my home. I was just a guest there, and a very fortunate one. I mean, I view myself as someone who won a winning lottery ticket. I had a golden ticket to a really good life, and I was treated incredibly well by very, very decent people. You know, I have nothing but good things to say about Americans in general. But the thing is that Americans, white Americans in particular, have this feeling that their tribe doesn't exist anymore. And a lot of them are looking to get out. They're looking to leave. They're looking to flee. They're looking to be free again to establish their own countries, their own nations, as it were. Now, a nation is indeed made up of a tribe. It is, or, you know, several tribes. I mean, if you look at the founding of America in particular, the original 13 colonies, right? Those 13 colonies were essentially 13 separate tribes. They came together to form one nation because they believed that they had enough in common and enough to go on to become a nation. What does it take to be a nation? I mean, I've explicated this a number of times. A nation is essentially a group of people that have, number one, a shared language. Number two, a shared culture. Number three, a shared history. When I say shared culture, by the way, I mean shared traditions, okay? Shared, common shared points of reference, if you will. A shared history. Number four, shared religion. They must more or less worship the same thing, the same ideas. And number five, a shared sense of blood and soil, you know. I've explicated it more clearly in the past, but that's basically what it is. Those five factors are what determine what is and is not a nation. Let's be clear about something. America today is not a nation. It's an empire held together by the threat of force on the geographical footprint of many nations. When you look at how Black America behaves itself, how Hispanic America behaves itself, how the urban elites or the coastal areas behave themselves versus how the heartland, you know, behaves itself, what you might call the difference between the Clinton archipelago and the Trump heartland, if you will. And there's a great map. You know, you can go look up Clinton archipelago versus Trump land in our webs, and you'll find it pretty quickly. It's a very informative graphic where it shows you, you know, the divide between the counties that voted for Trump versus the counties that voted for Clinton in 2016. And it really is very, very obvious exactly where the divides are, where the divisions are. Those are tribes. Those are very different tribes of people. Now, coming back briefly to that idea of American History X, which got me started on this whole thing, the tribe of the Black people in Los Angeles is distinctly different culturally, racially, genetically, philosophically, in every, just about in every way, from the white people that they interact with. The difference between the two is that the black tribe is very assertive and very sort of lethal in establishing dominance. They use force, they use violence, and they have no problem with that. And that is the story of blacks in America writ large. That is unfortunately the truth. There's a great interview by Colin Flaherty between Jared Taylor and Colin Flaherty on Jared Taylor's channel on BitChute, and I put it up in yesterday's great Monday Dact browser buster, where basically you could watch the two of them talking together. And Colin Flaherty is the writer of a great book called White Girl Bleed a Lot. Highly recommended. Definitely you should go check it out. I'll put a link to it in the description box for this podcast, and you can go look it up and read it if you want. Very strongly recommended. And in that book, Colin Flaherty basically details the appalling history of black-on-white crime and the extraordinary degree to which the mainstream media covers it up and refuses to report on it. Because, again, it runs counter to the narrative that somehow whites are constantly oppressing blacks. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing could be less true than that. The reality is that whites have lavished trillions upon trillions of dollars upon blacks to get them out of poverty, to get them out of the ghettos, to get them kind of into the mainstream of American civilization. And it hasn't worked. And in that interview, towards the end, Jared Taylor and Mr. Flaherty are talking together, and Mr. Taylor basically says, you know, if you look at blacks in America, they've basically disassociated themselves from the American nation. And that's true. They have. They've stopped trying to be part of the American experience. They have fundamentally rejected most American values, most particularly the idea of peaceable assembly, of peaceable redress of grievances, of rule of law, of living in peace with your neighbors. All of that's gone out the window. And they've replaced it with anarchy and violence. Now, I realize these are highly sweeping statements. I want to make it very clear. This is not all blacks, obviously. There are plenty of blacks who have been victims of violence themselves, inflicted upon them by their compatriots. They don't want any part of this. They want to live in peace. Good for them. I think it's probably the overwhelming majority of black people want that. But there's enough of them who don't want anything to do with white America that it's high time that white Americans maybe think about disassociating themselves and saying, you know what? Let's have a peaceful, and I emphasize the word peaceful, break away. Let's have, you know, if blacks keep saying we want our own nation, okay, fine. Give them their own nation. Let them run it the way they want to. And you could say, I mean, a lot of people will listen to this and argue, oh, you're arguing for a return to segregation, you horrible, vile racist, you. Yeah, voluntary segregation. Of the kind that we do to ourselves all the time. We routinely, on a daily basis, segregate ourselves voluntarily. And that's a good thing. We do not associate with those that we find unacceptable to our social milieu, who are not of us, who are not of our tribe. This concept of your tribe is going to become incredibly important to a lot of people over the coming years. There are a lot of white people right now wondering, who is my tribe? Where do I belong? They don't have a good answer to that. Now, a lot of white Americans, a lot of Americans full stop actually, a lot of Americans of my generation and maybe 10 years younger, you know, sort of in between that time span, are saying to themselves, I don't see any opportunities where I am. I want to leave. I want to go someplace better. I want to get out of where I am right now. I want to emigrate. I want to abandon this burning wreck of an empire that is collapsing in front of my eyes. I want to get out of the Anglosphere with its ridiculous rules and limitations, with its war on men, with its idiotic virtue signaling, with its incredibly dis-civic approach to law enforcement, with its promotion of all that is evil and disgusting and hedonistic, with its insistence that that gay quote unquote marriage is a thing, that a man can be a woman and a woman can be a man, with its relentless promotion of Marxist, communist, degenerate, foul ideology. I don't want any more of this. I don't want this stuff in my face anymore. That, I mean, that is essentially what I've been seeing from a lot of guys my age. A lot of people have been saying stuff like that. I endorse that point of view wholeheartedly. I know what they're saying. I've been saying the same things for years. I agree with them. It is really bad. So a lot of these guys basically say, you know, I'm going to go my own way. I'm going to become MGTOW, men going their own way. I do not agree with that at all. Becoming MGTOW means that by definition you are abandoning any idea of a tribe. You are becoming a pure individualist. The problem with that is that, and this is very much a Western Christian affliction I found. The problem with reducing everything to the atomized individual is that the atomized individual is free, yes. He can establish his own routines, his own rules, his own ways of doing things. That's great. That's wonderful. That's very nice for him to be able to do that. But it also means that it's very easy for him to be destroyed. Again, we come back to the doctrine of fascism. And again, let's be very clear. Fascism is fucking stupid. Don't fall for the lie. It's essentially socialism cloaked in some seemingly sensible ideas, but at its core, it's just socialism. But one of those sensible ideas is the idea of the fascias. Where does fascism get its name from? Fascias, the bundle of twigs. What does this mean? I think Mussolini basically outlined it best when he said that one twig by itself, you can snap it in two very easily. But when you have a bundle of twigs tied together, now you can't snap it. You can't break them. The idea being that the collective is stronger than the individual. Now, fascism and communism go exactly the wrong way by promoting the subsuming of the individual beneath the collective identity. And that's dumb. That's a very dumb way of doing things. But there is a point to be made that when you are part of a tribe, a collective, a group, you are much stronger than when you are alone. And this is the problem with the MGTOW solution. It doesn't work because you are abandoning any form of tribe. You are willfully avoiding the idea of setting up your own tribe. What is a family? It is your tribe. It is your people. Your wife, your children, they are your tribe. You have to protect them. You have to protect the extended family, if you can, if your loyalties extend that far. And before you know it, you've built a mini nation of your own. And when you have enough in common with other mini nations like that, you have yourself a true nation. By definition, when you go MGTOW, you abandon all of these things. So MGTOW is not a solution. Well, what else is? Okay, well, emigrating. Okay, maybe you could do that. You could do what a lot of digital entrepreneurs have done, do the digital nomad thing. I mean, I've done something like that for a while now, for almost a year, where I basically have done my own projects, I've lived off my savings, and created my own way of doing things away from any recognizable tribe, if you will. But that's not a long-term solution either, and I'll tell you why. Sooner or later, when you enter into another culture, you have to accept norms and ideas and ways of doing things that are not things you grew up with. And you're going to have to accept that that's the way it's done where you are. If you move to Russia or Ukraine or Croatia or Czech Republic or in any of these Central or Eastern European countries, they have a very different way of doing things. And you're just going to have to get used to that. if you don't like it, you're not going to be accepted. And in my experience, Russian and Slavic people in general are incredibly warm, hospitable, accepting. They seem very cold at first. I mean, they have a reputation for being cold fish at first, because, you know, there's the stereotype of the gruff Russian who just gives, you know, monosyllabic answers or grunts in response to a question. But actually, what you're going to find is, if you actually get to know Russian people on a deeper level, like beyond the, hey, how you doing, isn't it a nice day sort of level, and you get to talk to them, and you make friends with Russian people, they become your best friends for life. They would literally give you the shirt off their backs to help you out, if that's what it takes, because that's how they think, that's how they believe. And it's a very wonderful attitude that they have. But there are less savory aspects of their culture too. And if you don't like it, if you only want the good and you don't take the bad, then you're never going to be accepted as one of them. I mean, you're never going to be accepted as one of them anyway, if you're a foreigner. It's always going to be clear that you are a foreigner. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's just the way it is. As I've said many times before, as I've written many times before, xenophobia is a survival instinct. If you spend any significant amount of time in Russia, what you'll find is that Russians are not, I mean, they're not anti-black or anti-Indian or anti-anything, really. But they do have a certain expectation that if you come over to Russia, you'll act like a decent human being. You'll obey their laws. You'll obey their way of life. You'll respect Russian traditions and Russian ideals. You'll speak Russian. If you don't like it, there's the border. Get the hell out. Now, that's exactly the right attitude, and that's one of the reasons why I like Russians so much. But there is a very distinct difference between Russians and everyone else. And the reason for that is because Russians understand who their tribe is. If you talk to Russians, you'll often hear them talking about those damned Caucasians. That's more or less how they say it, actually. That's more or less how they talk about it. They basically say those people from the Kavkaz republics, Kavkaz as they pronounce it, they come over here and they're just criminals. They take our jobs. They ruin our streets. They act like animals when they're here. They're just horrible people, and they should be kicked out of Russia. Words to that effect, more or less. Now, who are these Caucasian peoples? Well, they're from republics such as Azerbaijan, Dagestan, Armenia, Georgia, Moldova. Some come from Albania, even as far away as that. These are all Slavic peoples, more or less. But it's very common to walk around on the streets of Moscow and you'll see guys, you know, with darker skin than is normal for Russians, and beards, doing the street cleaning and waiting in the restaurants. And even, you know, there'll be instructors in gyms and such. And there's a disproportionate number of gym instructors in Moscow who are actually Muslims from Islamic republics in the southwest of Russia. They too come from a tribe. They come from their own tribes, and they have entered into the Russian tribe to try to make a living. The Russians make it very clear who is and who is not Russian. And if you're not Russian, beyond a certain point, they don't have time for you. They don't want you there, beyond a certain point, unless you make the effort to really become one of them. And even then, you're not really going to be one of them. Not really. I know a French guy who lives in Moscow. He's married to a Russian woman. He has permanent residency in Russia, and he will qualify for Russian citizenship eventually. But permanent residency in Russia is not permanent. It's for 3 years, and then it has to be renewed. And to get it, you have to speak Russian. You have to pass a Russian language test. Now, again, that's how it should be. But their tribe is very clear. Their understanding of their tribe is really clear. And when you go there as a foreigner, as an expat, and you try to subsume yourself into them with the best will in the world, you're not going to be able to do it very easily. And sooner or later, you're going to be confronted with the reality that this is a wonderful, amazing, incredible, vibrant, astonishing place with gorgeous architecture and beautiful women and incredibly decent, warm, friendly, kind people, and tremendous infrastructure, great roads, great railways, phenomenal metro, terrific food, excellent world-class gyms, superb schools and universities, so on and so on and so on. I could wax lyrical about the glories of Russia all day long because I've spent so much time there. But it's not your home. It's not you. If you are an American looking to travel to Russia or to Ukraine or to anywhere else, yeah, you can do it. You could do it if you wanted to, and you could get away from the degenerate cesspit that is your hometown or city, and you could go to some place where they value tradition and they value female beauty, and they think that the idea of gay, quote-unquote, marriage is a bad joke, and they think that transgenderism is a mental disease, and they think that the old ways really are best in a lot of ways. They take religion and Christianity seriously. They respect churches. They respect faith. You could have all of these wonderful things, but it's not your tribe. They're not your people. They never will be. They will accept you as one of them if you make the effort, but you're not one of them. And that's okay. That realization is okay. That's a good thing. Sooner or later, you're going to have to choose who is your tribe. Who do you stand with? When things go deep into the shit, which they eventually always will, what are you going to stand up for? What systems of belief are you going to hold as your own? If you don't have any to hold as your own, you basically have nothing going for yourself. You have no base, no foundation, nothing to keep you strong. You have no way to build on anything. You have nothing that will stabilize you. You have fundamentally nothing. That's it. That's all there is to it. And if you decide to leave and go somewhere else, okay, you could do that. But sooner or later, you're going to be confronted with the reality that you are not among your tribe. You need to build your own tribe back up. And that comes back to a comment which somebody left on my blog, and I'm desperately looking for it right now. I can't remember exactly who it was, but it was somebody who basically moved to Eastern Europe and quite happily lived there for a long time. But he realized very quickly that, as much as he loved it in Eastern Europe, as much as he loves it in Eastern Europe, he still wasn't able to make it his own place. It wasn't his place. Rex, commenter Rex. He wrote a long comment. It's a great comment. It's phenomenal. He said, for Americans considering leaving the U.S., my wife and I emigrated from the U.S. a number of years ago. We moved to Eastern Europe where it's quite nice. They have a down-to-earth, friendly, homogeneous society. It's really great, but it's not our home. It's theirs. The other Americans both here and in other European countries tend to be shit-lib lefties who whine and complain about the U.S., but in the very next breath start pontificating to the locals how they should run things to be more like the U.S., like a bunch of damn Mexicans. The feminists bitch about the femininity of the local women and their traditions. Unfortunately, it's starting to show some visible effects. I can confirm that. Having lived in Moscow for a while, I can tell you far too many women here in Moscow, or you know, there in Moscow, I should say, have tattoos, act in very masculine ways. If you talk to the gym trainers there, my girlfriend was basically telling me the other day that she'd been talking to gym trainers, and they told her, one of the gym trainers who'd been there for a while said, over the last 5 years, I've seen a big change. I mean, men have become more feminized and women have become more masculinized. And it's really a tragedy to see. Going back to the comment, you can move here and turn the societal clock back a bit. Dial it back to a modified 1950s. You will have to learn a language. Yep, absolutely. It's fun at first, but then when you have to solve more complicated problems, you are opening yourself up to being misunderstood, and everything takes more time and resources because of the language barrier, no matter who speaks whose language. If you want to integrate, which you will never fully do because you aren't them, you will have to learn some of the customs. That's fun at first too, but eventually you start to feel the differences, because it's not what we do at Christmas, Easter, etc. There is no Memorial Day or Thanksgiving. Independence Day happens multiple times per year, depending on which era of history you're talking about, but not on July 4th. No beer, boats, or fireworks. Maybe you can watch your family do that over Skype, while they still can. You are going to have to give up your familiar annual hunting trips. Hunting is old world over there, here. No mossy oak, no state or federal land, or hunting on your own private property, but in a hunting society where the leader dictates who gets to shoot and when. If you shoot the trophy animal, you don't get to take it home. Fishing is different too. If you want to talk about guns, sure, other places may be worse than here, but it's still a far cry from the glories of even the tattered remnants of the Second Amendment in the US. And this is where his comment gets really, really good. So many Americans talk about packing up and leaving for greener pastures. My wife and I made it out a long time ago. But as the time to defend our home quickly approaches, there is a growing feeling in the gut that continuing to stay away is straight up cowardice. Leaving the US now is yellow. Are these guys going to move back to the US after someone else straightens it out? Are they going to sit back and relax in a new country with popcorn, disarmed, while grandma or their brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, literal blood who stayed behind, get necklaced, disemboweled, or God knows what else by, you know, the LGBTQ WTF is the shit crowd? Other countries might look nicer or even be nicer than the US. But it gets to be a little like visiting someone else whose house looks nicer than yours. In the end, it's not your house. You may not be there overstaying your welcome, but you do eventually get to the point where it's time to go home for the evening or to take care of business. I don't expect anyone to care what some random asshole on the internet thinks, but I couldn't abide staying overseas and watching my homeland and family burn from afar without doing anything to try to stop it. Sack up, gun up, grow a freaking spine, and stay to defend our home, fags. It's time to clean house. Everyone has to go back. What can you say to that other than, amen, Reverend? It's one of the best comments I've ever received in 7.5 years of writing. That's astonishing. I mean, that's a fantastic comment, and that gets the heart of everything. You can leave wherever you are. Eventually, you're going to have to find your tribe. You're going to have to find where you belong. And if you can't find it, you will be hunted down and you will be destroyed. No matter who you are, no matter how strong you are, no matter how much money you have, you cannot work in isolation. You have to find a tribe of like-minded people, not digitally, but in the real world. We, as humans, are not meant to be alone. We are meant to be around people. We are meant to work and hunt and live in packs. We are meant to be in a kind of society. And I'm saying that as somebody who's really, really introverted. I mean, my idea of fun, if I had my way, would probably involve, as our beloved and dreaded Supreme Dark Lord, peace be unto him, once said, buying a monastery and filling it full of first edition classics and spending all my days reading. That would be nice. I mean, that's a nice pipe dream. But the reality is it's never going to happen, because as a human being, I have the need to socialize. I have to be around people. So do you. you could argue and you could, you know, you can come back to me and say, Didact, it's all such a terrible place. I want to leave. I want to get out. Yeah, okay, fine. You know, you can get out. You can leave anytime you want. You can go back to the 1950s if you want. It's not that hard, actually. I mean, Aaron Clary, Captain Capitalism, wrote a classic post about this. I'll see if I can dredge it up and put it in the description box, where he talks about exactly this, about going back to the 50s. You could do it anytime you want. Just pack up your stuff and leave. Go to the countryside. Live in the country. Build that idyllic 1950s style lifestyle for yourself. You're going to have to sacrifice for it and strive for it. Not going to be fun, not necessarily, but you can do it. You can find a more traditionalist wife. You can find your own plot of land. You can get away from the LGBTQ WTF is this degeneracy out there in the country. You can be around like-minded Christian people. It's all possible. You just have to do it. But in the process, you have to be sure that you're among people that count as your tribe. And if you're not, doesn't matter how strong you think you are, you're going to be torn down and destroyed when, not if, but when the forces that are destroying the United States and much of the Western world come for you. Because it's going to happen. I'll leave off with one final thought about people like me who don't really know which tribe we belong to. And this is an increasingly large number of kids and young adults and, you know, old farts like me, now that I'm in my mid-30s. I grew up in many different places. By the time I was 18, I lived in 4 different countries. By the time I was 21, I lived in 6. I have lived effectively in 7 countries now. I have traveled to at least a dozen more, definitely more than a dozen. I have seen parts of the world that most people will never see, will never get a chance to see. I have almost nothing in common with the people of my country of birth whatsoever. I don't speak their languages. I don't eat their food. I don't worship their gods. I don't have any interest in their history. I don't have any interest in their culture. I am basically westernized, but I'm not of the West because my passport doesn't say so. And it's more than just a matter of a piece of paper which says you are a citizen of such and such. Citizenship is not a matter of a piece of paper. Citizenship is a matter of a state of mind. You know, to quote the words from Robert Heinlein's Starship Troopers, citizenship is an attitude, a state of mind, an emotional conviction that the whole is greater than the part, and that the part should be humbly proud to lay down its life that the whole may live. Now, there are some problems with Starship Troopers, which, I mean, I consider it to be one of the greatest books ever written. It's a civics lesson in the course of 267 pages, wrapped up in a science fiction novel, in a military science fiction novel, which also happens to be the best military sci-fi novel ever written. But be that as it may, you know, that's for another time. The point of this quote from Starship Troopers is that citizenship is much more than where you were born. Citizenship is much more than what passport you have. There are millions of people who have American citizenship right now who are not American. I have relatives who qualify for that. They have American citizenship, but they're not American. And eventually, whether they like it or not, they're going to have to go back. They have kids who are born in the US who consider themselves to be American. They don't consider themselves to be from the old country. They're not American at all. They espouse beliefs and ideas that are directly contradictory to everything that America stands for. They are not American and should not be there. They should go back. But then, where does that leave people like me, who don't really have a tribe, who don't have a sense of belonging to anywhere? Well, again, make your own tribe. Start your own families. Marry a woman. Have children. Create your own communities. Abandon, if you must, whatever baggage you had with you from whatever culture you think you came from, if you're in that situation. and wholeheartedly adopt the customs and culture of the place you're in. Even then, you're not going to be one of them, nor should you be considered as one of them, because you're not. But you can make a pretty reasonable facsimile of it. You know, it works better in some countries than in others. If you go to China, the Chinese, as far as they're concerned, you're not Chinese, unless you are ethnically Han Chinese, and they do not permit dual citizenship at all. You cannot be a citizen of China and another country. They don't allow it. If you are ethnically Han Chinese, then you are Chinese. And it doesn't matter what other citizenship you adopt, you are still Chinese. But you cannot hold another passport at the same time. If you go to Japan, I mean, there are like fifth generation Koreans living in Japan who are not, they have Japanese passports and everything. They are not considered Japanese by the Japanese people around them. There are sumo wrestlers from Mongolia who, you know, went to Japan and had great careers there, adopted Japanese citizenship, got married to Japanese women, had kids there. They're not Japanese. According to the Japanese people, they're not Japanese. Okay? You could do that in Russia. You could go to Ukraine. You could go to Eastern Europe and marry a Russian or Slavic girl and settle down there and have a good life. And you could speak, you could eventually probably speak Russian to at least fluency. I mean, you could get to the point where you might even be able to read the works of Dostoevsky and Pushkin in the native language and understand it and appreciate it. But you're not Russian. You're not Slavic. You're not Eastern European. Okay, you're not of them. You don't share in that culture. You can make a fair go of it, but you will always be an alien. You will always be a member of a different tribe. That's the price you have to pay. That's something you can't get past. And until and unless you come to a culture like what the ancient Romans had, where basically the Roman system of adoption worked such that if somebody adopted, if a patriarch of a family adopted a son from another family, that adopted son was basically considered a blood relative. That doesn't exist in most societies and never will. But until and unless you get to a society like that again, you're not going to have that complete acceptance that you want. So you're going to have to do the best you can with what you have. My advice to you is the same as the advice I give myself. Find your tribe. Create your own tribe if you must. Find what is worth defending and fighting for, and build on that. And when it comes time to take up arms to defend your tribe, be very clear. There's no turning away. There's no running away from that. You can't turn back. You've made your choice. So stand and defend your tribe. We're running out of time here, so let's wrap it up. This has been Didactic Mind, episode 38, Return to Tribe. It's inspired by a song by one of my very favorite metal bands, or used to be, actually. They used to be a metal band called Edguy, a German band. I'll link to their song, too, in the description. You can go check it out. This has been Didact. As always, go check out the blog at didactsreach.blogspot.com, or eventually it will be didacticmind.com, and check out superbshaving.com. Links will all be in the description box. And I will catch you on the next one, which should be this Sunday. This is Didact, signing off.